Arrested, the fire drove Friday's climate protest in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to Chris Belcher. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Honey Masood, Trina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriana Contreras, and Maria Terracena. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Portland. The time is 4:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Here are some messaging before the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feet to Fire campaign and protest on Wednesday, January 15th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse in Portland. The Feet to Fire campaign is part of a national campaign started by Protect Our Stolen Treasures out of Detroit. This peaceful protest happens every month outside of a different county courthouse and calls for justice for those lost to police violence and hate crimes, particularly those who were in a mental health crisis when they were killed by police. Again, that's Feet to the Fire campaign and protest on Wednesday, January 15th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse, 1021 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Not So Supernova on Saturday, January 18th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church in Portland. Not So Supernova is a full-length one-woman play exploring the edges of motherhood and marriage with humor and depth. Again, that's Not So Supernova on Saturday, January 18th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church, 4033 Southeast Woodstock Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Natural Grocers, which is donating 2.5% of company-wide sales this MLK Day to the Jack and Jill Gap Fund for historically black colleges and universities.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two Patriot Prayer members have pleaded guilty to rioting in the May Day brawl at Cider Riot.
Oregonians prepare for snow.
And Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek declares Oregon's homelessness crisis an emergency.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 13th, 2020. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Nat Moon. Two of the six men who were charged with rioting last May outside Southeast Portland's Cider Riot have accepted a plea deal. The two men opted to plead guilty to the crimes rather than face a jury trial. All six men that have been charged are associated with Patriot Prayer, a right-wing group based in Vancouver, Washington. One of the men charged, Joey Gibson, is the group's leader. Matthew Cooper and Chris Ponte reached plea agreements with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office for their riot charges. Both men were sentenced to 120 hours of community service and 3 years of probation. During those 3 years, the men must refrain from participating in any unpermitted protest in Multnomah County. The DA's office also asked the court to sentence both men to 10 days in jail. However, the court decided that only Ponte should serve out that sentence. It's unclear if any of the other four defendants, Joey Gibson, Ian Kramer, Mackenzie Lewis, and Russell Schultz, are currently negotiating similar plea deals with the DA's office. Of the six men, Kramer is the only one who has been held in jail since his August arrest. He is facing three felony charges for allegedly hitting a woman with a baton so forcefully that she was knocked unconscious and suffered a vertebrae fracture. All six men are also named in a separate civil lawsuit filed by Cider Riot owner Gabe Abe Goldman Armstrong, accusing the men of acting negligently and trespassing on private property. In a press release, the DA's office said, quote, "The conviction means that Cooper and Ponte are no longer disputing that on May 1st, 2019, they, along with five or more others, engaged in tumultuous and violent conduct and thereby intentionally or recklessly created a grave risk of causing public alarm."
Following the imminent threat of snow, the Joint Office of Homeless Services is opening at least three no-turnaway shelters in Portland tonight. The Joint Office's contractor, Transition Projects, will make about 2,000 beds available tonight for Portlanders that are in need of shelter. The three current shelter locations include Bud Clark Commons at 650 Northwest Irving, Imago Day on Southeast Ankeny, and Sunrise Center at 18901 East Burnside. If all the sites are full, more community centers are on standby to provide additional shelter space. From today until Thursday, Portland is expecting cold weather, freezing rain, and potential sticking snow. The peak of the storm is expected to be Tuesday night through Thursday morning, as the temperatures will fall below freezing and could cause dangerous driving conditions.
Oregon House Speaker Democrat Tina Kotek said that Oregon's crisis of unsheltered homelessness has reached emergency status. The Portland Democrat is preparing to push a funding proposal in next month's legislative session that would declare a statewide emergency, allowing cities anywhere in the state to more easily site homeless shelters. Her effort includes a push for an allocation of up to $100 million that could be spent improving and expanding Oregon shelters. Kotek also wants to establish navigation centers in Eugene and Salem, which would offer low-barrier shelter, case management, and other services to unsheltered people. In 2015, the city of Portland declared a housing emergency that allowed city agencies and nonprofit providers to more easily site homeless shelters. Kotek hopes the entire state can follow this example. The results of a statewide shelter study released last August illustrates the state's ineffective efforts to aid people experiencing homelessness. The study reports that Oregon is one of four states in which more than half of all people experiencing homelessness were found in unsheltered locations. Kotek hopes to commission a study that could lead to a state voucher system to help poorer people pay for housing. She is still working on her proposition and looking into what a housing state of emergency would specifically entail.
A man and his two children were swept out to sea last Saturday afternoon near Falcon Cove, south of Cannon Beach. The father, identified as 47-year-old Jeremy Stiles of Portland, was found struggling to shore by police around 1 p.m. and taken to the hospital. He's expected to survive. His 7-year-old daughter was rescued soon after and taken to the hospital, where she was pronounced dead. The Coast Guard conducted a search for the 4-year-old son on shore and by helicopter. A boat was not deployed because of the dangerous conditions. The search for the boy was called off after about 5 hours due to lack of sunlight. On Sunday, the Coast Guard said they would not continue the search, suspending it indefinitely. A high surf and coastal flood warning were in effect during the time of the incident, which warned of large and dangerous waves with breakers of 35 to 40 feet. A king tide event was in effect all weekend, meaning waves were higher than usual, with high surf on beaches strong enough to move beach logs and crash over jetties. Swells coming down from the North Pacific can expose Oregon coast beaches to intermittent periods of dangerously high surf, peaking from November through March.
The U.S. House is set to vote on a bill containing reforms that are meant to protect unionizing workers from intimidation within their workplace. Melissa Hood has more.
The U.S. House has committed to voting on a comprehensive bill supporting union organizing before President's Day. The announcement comes after 68 representatives, including Oregon Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici, sent a letter to House leadership urging them to bring the Protecting the Right to Organize Act to the floor. The bill contains a suite of reforms, including eliminate right-to-work laws, rules prohibiting employers from delaying negotiating collective bargaining contracts, and penalties for retaliating against union organizing. Graham Traynor is president of the Oregon AFL-CIO.
It's commonplace in private sector union organizing in Oregon and across the country that workers are intimidated, they're scared. Employers use mandatory one-on-one meetings to intimidate workers from joining a union, and it really stacks the deck against the group of workers who want to see change.
The PRO Act has 218 co-sponsors, with every Democratic House member in Oregon signing on except for Representative Kurt Schrader. While the bill's chances are good in the House, it's considered dead on arrival in the Senate. Traynor says it's still important for the House to vote on it.
I recognize the political hurdles and challenges of today's bill and with today's Congress and administration, but that's not to say that this isn't a multi-year strategy. That's not to say that this shouldn't continue to be an issue that we press lawmakers to tackle in a really serious way over the coming years.
Traynor sees unions rising across the country, especially among young people. In 2017, more than three-quarters of new members were younger than 35, and a 2018 poll by the Pew Research Center found nearly 70% of people ages 18 to 29 have a favorable view of unions. For KBOO Evening News and Oregon News Service, I'm Melissa Hood.
The Oregon Department of Transportation has created a new office to address transportation issues and carry out major projects. The Office of Urban Mobility and Mega Project Delivery represents a new focus on comprehensive and inclusive transportation solutions. Goals of the newly formed office center around developing and implementing comprehensive solutions to congestion, access, and mobility issues. The new office does not only have a commitment to addressing congestion, but aims to show a new way of doing business. The organization looks to focus through a lens of equity when improving transportation in the state, providing more accessible transportation, and economic opportunities for everyone. Work in the new office will include a focus on the I-5 Rose Quarter Improvement Project, the I-205 and Abernathy Bridge Project, and active development of a tolling and congestion pricing program. ODOT has named Brendan Finn as the director of the new office, Della Mosier as the deputy director, and Lucinda Broussard as the tolling program manager. The new leading staff will add more employees later this year to help achieve the goals of the new office.
This evening, Metro Regional Government is holding a public comment meeting about its proposed transportation funding package for the November ballot. Metro's multi-billion dollar transportation package is focused around corridors in the region, which are major thoroughfares that are smaller than freeways. The largest investment would be in the Southwest Corridor, where TriMet hopes to build a MAX line connecting Southwest Barber with Tigard. The funds would also go towards simple safety improvements to more transformational ones, like adding bus priority lanes. The priority corridors were determined based on safety, public transit need, and curbing climate change. Metro has not identified a funding mechanism yet, though they are reportedly considering a payroll tax. The meeting starts at 5:30 and will go until 9 and will be solely devoted to public comment. The meeting is located at the Metro Regional Center at 600 Northeast Grand Avenue. For those unable to attend, written testimony on the proposed measure can be submitted by emailing getmoving@oregonmetro.gov.
Miles of a southern Oregon highway are closed due to winter weather and dangerous conditions, as reported by the Oregon Department of Transportation Monday morning. Mountain snow has knocked down multiple trees onto Highway 230 earlier today, making travel impossible. ODOT crews closed the main route from Medford to Diamond Lake late Sunday evening. The affected stretch covers roughly 24 miles, with the highway's intersection at Highway 138 through its course meeting Highway 62 near the Union Creek intersection. With over 100 trees downed and hundreds more burdened by ongoing snowfall, the closure will be in effect for the next 24 hours, possibly longer, according to traffic authorities. Though seasonal weather of this magnitude is not unusual for the area, two more winter systems are expected through Wednesday morning, with more traffic reroutes expected. Areas affected include Ashland, Jacksonville Hill, Butte Falls, and Rouche. A winter advisory is in effect for these and all surrounding areas, with elevations over 1,800 feet until Wednesday.
Big Feet have a shot at a big win next month for Hillsborough-based film studio Laika, as their recently awarded film Missing Link lands an Oscar nomination. Missing Link was awarded a Golden Globe last week for Best Animated Feature Film, beating out several major blockbuster contenders. The stop-motion animated flick tells the story of a Northwest Bigfoot traveling to find Yeti relatives. It is the first Golden Globe win for Laika and has become their sixth Academy Award nomination. Applauded for its handcrafted and distinctive look, Missing Link features the voices of Hugh Jackman, Emma Thompson, Zach Galifianakis, and Zoe Saldana.
Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey announced Monday that he's dropping out of the Democratic presidential nomination race. Booker's departure from the field leaves just one black candidate, Deval Patrick, in a party where black voters are an essential bloc. Booker was polling at about 2% nationally on average and recently failed to qualify for a second consecutive debate. Booker wrote in an email to supporters, quote, "Our campaign has reached the point where we need more money to scale up and continue building a campaign that can win, money we don't have, and money that's harder to raise because I won't be on the next debate stage, because the urgent business of impeachment will rightly be keeping me in Washington." Booker is up for re-election to the Senate this year and still enjoys mostly favorable ratings in New Jersey, which has not elected a Republican senator in more than 40 years.
Author Marianne Williamson has dropped out of the Democratic primary. With that story and more, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
At the end of, you know, the end days of a campaign, and I'm sure this is true to some extent for everyone, maybe not for everyone actually, but certainly for me, there's a lot of woulda, shoulda, coulda. This is certainly nothing I've ever done before.
Author Marianne Williamson dropped out of the race for the Democratic primary on Friday after giving her very last interview as a presidential candidate to 2020 Talks.
I have, if anything, even greater respect and admiration for the American people than I ever had before. The older I get, the more profound it is, I realize, the Jeffersonian concept that the only safe place for the repository of power is in the hands of the average citizen.
She finished her campaign with a couple events in New Hampshire this weekend, leaving 13 Democrats still in the race. With tomorrow night's Democratic debate in Des Moines and the First of the Nation caucuses 3 weeks away, there have been a lot of travelers to the Hawkeye State lately, including candidates of both parties, their surrogates, and young activists. Students with Jewish Voice for Peace Action concluded a bus tour they called the Palestinian Freedom 2020 Bus this weekend, and they showed up before several campaign events to speak about candidates' records and ask the candidates and their representatives to support conditioning aid to Israel on justice for Palestinians. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg are the only ones who've suggested they'd consider conditions. But Sanders, out of the three, has been the most forthright about equality for Palestinians, says JVP Action's Beth Miller.
Israel is already carrying out a de facto annexation of the West Bank, and there are severe human rights violations happening every day against Palestinians, and we need to end military funding now.
Mo Elsherbini, president of American University's chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, says the candidates who won't consider conditioning aid to Israel are why he joined the group in Iowa to push them on it.
As an Egyptian-Palestinian, my family had to deal with a lot of erasure of our Palestinian identity when my family fled from Palestine in 1948. Therefore, it's been really hard for me to claim that identity, and I have been trying to do that. And the best way for me to do that, I think, at least, is kind of take part in that tradition of resistance that Palestinians have been known for so long, since 1920 and since even before then.
Ben Beanstalk, student at Brown University, has a blunt take on what brought him to Iowa with JVP Action.
As a Jew, I've seen the way that the Israeli government and the Israeli military and the United States in its support for the Israeli military and government uses me and my Jewish peers as an excuse for the actions that they do, that they claim to conduct.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
According to a new study published in the medical journal JAMA Surgery, e-scooter-related injuries jumped 222% between 2014 and 2018. During just the last year of the study, injuries increased by 83%. Injuries were most likely to occur during the first ride, and riders aged 18 to 34 were the most likely to be injured. Fractures, contusions, and abrasions were the most common types of injuries. About half of reported incidents occur because of poor road conditions, while the other half consists of a mix of speeding, collision with a motor vehicle, hitting curbs, or a scooter malfunction. The data was taken from studies conducted in larger cities across the U.S. There's been one study in Portland published earlier this month, which found that riding an e-scooter resulted in only 5% of the total traffic-related injury visits to emergency rooms and urgent care centers. Reports urge riders to educate themselves about the proper use of e-scooters before taking a ride and highlight the importance of always wearing a helmet and maintaining a safe speed while riding an e-scooter.
Over the past few years, the U.S. Senate has confirmed 185 of President Donald Trump's judicial nominees, the majority of whom have a conservative track record. Nadia Ramoglan has more.
Along with two Supreme Court justices, senators have confirmed 50 circuit court and 133 district court judges, according to State's newsroom reporter Allison Stevens, who has covered politics for nearly a decade. The sheer number of conservative confirmations amounts to what some are calling a repeal of progressive reforms that harken back to the New Deal.
And what President Trump is doing and Mitch McConnell is supporting and doing in the Senate is supporting hundreds of conservative judges who oppose a lot of progressive reforms throughout the country.
The Senate recently confirmed Lee Philip Rudofsky as federal judge for the Eastern District of Arkansas, which includes Little Rock. Stevens says Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell regularly speaks in public about his goal of filling all of the remaining vacancies left on the federal judiciary.
But I don't think it's something that the media pays much attention to, and I don't think it's something that the public really cares all that much about, for the most part.
She says groups such as the American Constitution Society and the Alliance for Justice are trying to change that.
They're trying to call attention to the impact that these judges have on so many aspects of daily life. But in general, they do sort of fly under the radar.
According to the American Constitution Society, more than 70 vacancies on district and circuit courts have yet to be filled. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
The December Pensacola Navy base shooting that killed three American service members and injured eight others has been declared an act of terrorism. Attorney General William Barr announced today that the shooting carried out by a Saudi pilot was motivated by jihadist ideology. The shooter was part of a U.S. training program for the Saudi military and, according to investigators, had posted anti-American, anti-Israeli, and jihadist messages on social media just hours before the attack. On September 11th, he wrote on social media that, quote, "the countdown has begun." 21 other Saudi cadets who were not connected to the attack had been removed from the U.S. as a result of the investigation. Some had expressed derogatory sentiments about the U.S., and 15 of them were found to be in possession of child pornography during the investigation. They do not face charges, but Saudi Arabia has removed them from training due to their conduct. It's not uncommon for foreign nationals to come into the U.S. to train with the military. Many of their governments buy military equipment from the U.S. The Florida shooting has raised questions about the vetting process, and authorities say they did not previously connect the shooter to the accounts where he made anti-American statements since he used a different name and photo.
Florida panthers are solitary, elusive animals that are rarely observed in the wild. Fewer than 200 Florida panthers remain in their wild habitat today, but conservation groups are now suing to protect these animals from deadly road projects. Trimmel Gomes has more.
Conservation groups filed a lawsuit on Thursday against state and federal agencies over road widening projects in the middle of Florida's critical panther habitats. Widening projects along State Roads 29 and 82 in southwest Florida also include the first continuous flow intersection in the state, designed to help traffic flow more smoothly while drivers are attempting left turns. State Road 82 will go from two lanes to six, and Earth Justice staff attorney Bonnie Malloy says that spells trouble for Florida's endangered panthers when 85% of their deaths are on roadways.
Obviously, bigger, wider roads means further areas for the Panther to cross and more vehicles on the road for the Panther to try to dodge. So there's different ways to take that into consideration and mitigate for those impacts, and the agencies are failing to do that.
On behalf of the Sierra Club and the Environmental Confederation of Southwest Florida, Earth Justice filed suit against the Florida Department of Transportation, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Florida transportation officials have said the roads will pay big dividends to those who use them. Among several claims, Malloy says the lawsuit points out the Florida Department of Transportation excluded its own findings, that the road widening is likely to adversely affect the Florida Panther by destroying key habitat and increasing the potential for fatal motor vehicle collisions.
Unfortunately, with these projects, there seems to be a trend where they're doing inadequate level of review and just pushing these through, which is, of course, causing great alarm for us and the species and habitat that it'll impact.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued a biological opinion that the roadwork was unlikely to hurt the panther, but the lawsuit claims that conclusion is flawed. On the federal endangered species list since 1967, there are now only 100 to 160 Florida panthers left in the wild, and Malloy says Southwest Florida is their last remaining wild territory. For Public News Service, I'm Tramell Gomes.
In the wake of the drone attack that killed Iranian military leader Qassem Soleimani on January 3rd, the executive branch justified its actions by saying that Soleimani posed a, quote, imminent threat. Now it seems that defense is slipping away. Over the weekend, Defense Secretary Mark Esper implied that the president was not referring to any particular intelligence that would suggest an imminent threat to American citizens, but rather a belief of his own. Today, Trump tweeted that whether there was an imminent threat or not, quote, doesn't really matter. He also retweeted an edited photo of Democrats Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi in front of the Iranian flag wearing traditional Iranian clothing. The question of whether or not Soleimani posed an imminent threat is important because the Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war, not the president. In the modern era, the president has considerable power as commander-in-chief of the military, but orchestrating an assassination without just cause is not within those powers. Soleimani's death has escalated tensions between the U.S. and Iran, leading to Iran tearing up the 2015 nuclear deal and making the region less safe.
A second day of protests are taking place in Iran after the country's leadership admitted its military shot down a Ukrainian passenger plane by accident. This admission comes despite days of denials that Iranian military forces were to blame. The incident took place during a period of heightened tensions between Iran and the U.S. A group of protesters outside a university in Tehran chanted, quote, "They are lying that our enemy is America. Our enemy is right here." Marches also took place at Tehran's Azadi Freedom Square and in other Iranian cities. The Ukraine International Airlines plane was down just minutes after taking off from Tehran's airport. Many on board the plane were Iranians with dual citizenship. All 176 passengers were killed. Residents in Tehran said that police were out in full force on Sunday, with some protesters calling on officers to join them. Video posted online shows demonstrators running from police using batons and tear gas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for our live News in Depth segment with guest Meg Vogt, who's launching a project, Rawhide Ranch, to provide a fun, safe outdoor space for dogs and their owners. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with rain showers and a low of 35. Tomorrow, we'll see snow showers before noon with a high of 40 degrees. Today in history, in 1910, the first ever public radio broadcast was transmitted in New York City. It's credited to Lee DeForest and featured the voices of the stars of the Metropolitan Opera. The public and the press used earphones to listen to the broadcast from several locations throughout the city and marked the beginning of universal wireless radio communication. The quote of the day is from writer Guy Gugliotta, who said of radio, quote, "Perhaps no invention of modern times has delivered so much while initially promising so little."
Over the weekend, hundreds held demonstrations in Canada to oppose a natural gas pipeline project. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, hundreds of people marched in Vancouver and Winnipeg over the weekend to protest a natural gas pipeline project. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, they are also supporting a First Nation which is fighting the pipeline.
One march went from the British Columbia Supreme Court to a downtown square. The anger is over an injunction order last week that gives people at a protest camp 72 hours to allow construction workers to do their work. Coastal GasLink, which owns the pipeline, has deals in place with 20 elected First Nations councils along the pipeline's 350-mile route. However, it does not have the support of hereditary chiefs, which have authority over the broader territory. In Winnipeg, protesters held a round dance in support of the opponents of the pipeline.
To show solidarity across Canada and across North America, that we're here to show solidarity for our relatives and our people, and to also hold accountability and transparency to RCMP, and just so that like we are watching and we will take action and we will always be in solidarity with our relatives no matter what until the end.
Last week, the United Nations Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination called for a halt to the project. It said the project does not respect the rights of Indigenous people, and the province's Human Rights Commissioner supported that, saying, "There are obligations to ensure free, prior, and informed consent for all impacted Indigenous groups before such projects impact their lands." For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A county in northwest Montana is no longer transferring patients from the Indian Health Service to other hospitals. County officials say the IHS owes nearly $2 million for ambulance services dating back to 2014 and are now suing the federal agency, which it says can't verify the county's claims. Aaron Bolton explains.
Glacier County commissioners canceled the county's contract to transfer patients from the Blackfeet Community Hospital in Browning to other hospitals for additional care last month, saying the agency failed to hold up its end of the deal. IHS says it has been working for 9 months to substantiate the roughly $1.8 million worth of claims the county says went unpaid between 2014 and 2018. The agency says the county was not providing proper documentation for it to do so. The county now hopes to settle the dispute via a lawsuit in U.S. District Court. The county filed its suit on December 17th, arguing that it can't provide proper documentation to support its claim because IHS didn't produce that paperwork when its doctors requested ambulance transfers. IHS declined to comment on the court case. The county is asking the court to order IHS to immediately pay the $1.8 million in question with interest. A request for comment was not returned by the Glacier County attorney in time for this story. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A second Native American U.S. presidential forum is taking place this week, hosted by the voting rights group Four Directions. All candidates running for president are invited to the event Tuesday and Wednesday in Las Vegas, Nevada. As of Monday, five candidates were confirmed. The first forum took place in Sioux City, Iowa in August, focusing solely on Native issues. The Navajo Nation Attorney General and lawyers for the tribe are holding meetings in four New Mexico Navajo communities this week, impacted by the 2015 Gold King Mine waste spill, which devastated farmers and ranchers in the Four Corners region. The tribe has filed a lawsuit against the federal government and a separate lawsuit for individual claims. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As of today, marriage equality is finally legal in Northern Ireland. The change means that marriage equality has passed in all of the United Kingdom after the rest of the nation legalized same-sex marriage in 2014. The House of Commons in Northern Ireland voted to legalize in July, but it was possible the move could have been voided. The deadline for that passed in October. Since then, legislators had to reform laws and conduct an additional vote. The deadline for those reforms was today. Now, a 28-day waiting period begins for couples who register to marry. The first weddings under the new law in Northern Ireland are expected to take place on Valentine's Day.
The number of animals estimated to have died in Australia's wild bushfires has skyrocketed to more than 1 billion. Chris Dickman, an ecologist at the University of Sydney, said his original estimate of 480 million animals was not only conservative, it was also exclusive to the state of New South Wales and did not include significant groups of wildlife for which they had no population data. That figure excluded animals including bats, frogs, invertebrates, and livestock. The new estimate is over 1 billion. However, true numbers will not be known until after the fires subside. Stuart Blanch, an environmental scientist at World Wildlife Fund Australia, confirmed these estimates, adding, quote, "It's our climate impact and our obsession with coal that is helping wage war on our own country." It's possible that critically endangered species such as the southern corroboree frog and mountain pygmy possum could be completely wiped out as the fires destroy their crucial habitats. Koalas have lost more than 30% of their key habitat in New South Wales and may have even lost one-third of their population in that region. Horrifying footage of thousands of dead and charred animals lying beside roads has taken over social media as the National Defense Force is rushing to dig mass graves to avoid a health emergency. The fires across Australia have killed 25 people, destroyed or damaged more than 2,000 homes, and burned nearly 31,000 square miles. The bushfires alone are believed to have released as much as two-thirds of the nation's annual carbon dioxide emissions.
Explosive volcanic activity struck in the Philippines Sunday evening, forcing tens of thousands of residents to flee their homes. The Taal volcano, one of the region's most active, fired ash and steam miles upward, while lava gushed freely from the eruption site. As clouds of dark ash blew just north of Manila, more than 500 flights were shut down at the capital's main airport. No casualties have been reported to date as local authorities continue to evacuate residents. The eruption triggered 144 earthquakes in the region, according to the Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology, with officials urging further evacuations of hundreds of thousands as potential future tremors are predicted.
The temperatures of the world's oceans hit a record high level in 2019. A new analysis published in the journal Advances in Atmospheric Science shows that the past 5 years have been the warmest years recorded for the Earth's oceans. The amount of heat being added is equivalent to every person on the planet running 100 microwave ovens all day and all night. The warming of the oceans has far-reaching consequences, including more severe storms, the disruption of the water cycle, and rising sea levels. Higher temperatures also hurts life in the oceans. Professor Michael Mann from Penn State University said, quote, "We found that 2019 was not only the warmest year on record, it displayed the largest single-year increase of the entire decade, a sobering reminder that human-caused heating of our planet continues unabated." The analysis uses ocean data from multiple sources, including the 3,800 free-drifting Argo floats dispersed across the surface of the seas, and also from torpedo-like bathy thermographs dropped from ships in the past. The results show heat increasing at an accelerating rate as greenhouse gases continue to accumulate in the atmosphere. The new analysis assesses the heat in the top 2,000 meters of the ocean, which is where the vast majority of heat accumulates and where most marine life resides.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has listed a group of environmental activists engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience as extremists. According to internal DHS documents obtained by The Guardian, some of Climate Direct Action's members have been listed alongside white nationalists and mass killers. The group is often called the Valve Turners after they closed the valves on pipelines in four states carrying crude oil from Canada on October 11th of 2016. For a few hours, the oil stopped flowing, and the protest was later described as the largest coordinated action of its kind. Five members of Climate Direct Action cut through fencing and turned off the valves after notifying the energy companies of their plans. They then patiently waited to be arrested. In a recent intelligence bulletin evaluating domestic terrorism threats, DHS described the group as, quote, suspected environmental rights extremists. Two of the valve turners are listed alongside violent white supremacists who have been convicted of mass murder. The document also states that among the primary drivers of terrorist attacks in the U.S. between 2018 and 2020 are, quote, racial and environmentally themed ideologies. Mike German, a former FBI agent who is now with the Brennan Center for Justice, said in response that the DHS framing was, quote, highly misleading because white supremacists are responsible for the bulk of this violence and almost all of the fatalities that result. There's little evidence that environmentalists have engaged in the types of deadly violence that would meet the statutory definition of domestic terrorism as codified by Congress.
The success of reintroducing wolves in Yellowstone National Park has inspired a new ballot measure in Colorado to do the same. As Eric Galatas reports, proponents of reintroducing wolves in Colorado say the animals will help restore a national balance between predator and prey, as well as entire ecosystems.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gunn. In Canada, hundreds of people...
Sunday marked 25 years since wolves were reintroduced in Yellowstone National Park in central Idaho, and wildlife advocates are hoping Colorado voters will consider the program's success when deciding on Initiative 107 on the November ballot. The measure would direct Colorado Parks and Wildlife to create a plan to reintroduce wolves by December 2023. Jonathan Proctor with Defenders of Wildlife says the work in Yellowstone offers a blueprint for bringing the predator back to its historic habitat.
We have 25 years of experience and data and facts to understand the benefits of wolf restoration to the Northern Rockies. We can use those lessons learned and finish the job here in the Southern Rockies.
Some hunters oppose the measure, citing concerns about the potential loss of elk. Proctor says after wolves returned to Wyoming, elk populations actually increased and hunters had higher success rates. He says wolves restore a natural balance between predator and prey and entire ecosystems. They keep elk moving instead of clustering around waterways, which protects fish habitat and keeps watersheds clean. Ranchers have also voiced concerns about the potential loss of livestock. Proctor says livestock loss in Yellowstone and Idaho since wolves were reintroduced turned out to be just 0.1% of herd numbers. He adds that Initiative 107 would include compensation for ranchers.
And although we expect the losses to be very, very small in the region of Colorado, if we compare that to what's happened in the Northern Rockies over the past 25 years, you know, those losses are real to individual ranchers, and we should take that very seriously.
He says ranchers in Wyoming are also ready to share strategies that have avoided losses altogether. Proctor points to a recent survey showing two-thirds of Colorado voters support reintroducing wolves and says most people understand that bringing wolves back would benefit all of the region's inhabitants. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatas.
Clear Creek Middle School in Gresham, Oregon has been named an Oregon winner in the Samsung Solve for Tomorrow contest. Teacher Tom Erickson's 7th and 8th grade students proposed a plan to address emergency vehicle safety and response time and will receive $15,000 in new technology for their achievement. They proposed a system where passenger vehicles are notified as an emergency vehicle approaches an intersection by tapping into the system that police and fire departments use to control traffic signals. When activated, the cars will stop short of the intersection to reduce obstacles. This is the third time in 4 years that Erickson's class has been a state winner, which has earned Clear Creek Middle School $85,000 in instructional technology. All 100 state winners from around the country will work on their projects and submit a 3-minute video to try to advance to the next round. 20 finalist schools will present to a panel of judges, and 5 grand prize winners will receive $100,000 in technology, as well as travel to Washington, D.C. to present their projects to members of Congress.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, January 13, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Melissa Hood, Yasmin Kobanoglu, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Nadia Ramlagan, Eric Galatis, Trimmel Gomes, Antonia Gonzalez, and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, it's alternative radio featuring interviews and lectures from progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Stage and Studio, where host Dee Mae Roberts talks with performing, literary, and media artists from the Portland metro area and around the Northwest. At 11:30, hear Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan will be speaking with Alexis Day about her new show of tapestries and how she tries to conduct psychologically dense scenes from family life inside modern homes. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, you can go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. And now please stay tuned for our live news in-depth segment with guest Meg Vogt, who's launching a project Rawhide Ranch to provide a fun, safe, outdoor space for dogs and their owners.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
It's been said that a dog is man's best friend. I'd like to add that our in-depth guest today, Meg Vogt, can be considered a dog's best friend. Meg is affectionately known as the Dog Bus Lady of Sullivan's Gulch. The reason for that nickname is Meg's daycare for dogs called Dog's Rule and the big blue bus she uses to transport those dogs, which has become a familiar and welcome sight in Northeast Portland. Meg's become somewhat of a dog whisperer due to her great love and understanding for our canine friends. And now she's taken on a project, Rawhide Ranch, to create a safe place for dogs to roam leash-free without roaming too far away and getting lost. Meg's here live in the studio to tell us more about Rawhide Ranch and her work. Meg Vogt, thanks for coming into KBOO on this freezing evening.
Hey, Ken, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate your work here.
Now, Meg, you started your dog care business, Dogs Rule, back in 2004. Can you tell us a little bit about the business and what led to its creation?
Oh, yeah, actually, starting from the very beginning, in 2004, my wife was diagnosed with metastatic cancer, 6% survival rate. Colon cancer went to her liver. So I just quit my real job, quote unquote, and was just wanting to be with her through all the chemo and doctors and started walking dogs. I was working closely with In Defense of Animals and helping Matt Rozelle, who headed it at the time, helping him walk dogs. And so I just started branched out with the help of Matt Rozelle and was able to walk dogs around Deb's chemo and doctor schedule. And just as a note, Deb is now a world-class race walker and walks faster than I run and is very healthy. So,
very happy, that's ending.
How it all got started.
And Dogs Rule, your company, got a big boost in 2008 when you bought what became the now iconic Blue Dog Bus. What was the reason for the purchase, and how many canine clients currently use the bus?
Well, it is funny. I got it because I have a bad shoulder and I couldn't lift the dogs in my Toyota pickup anymore. So I'm not the, you know, I didn't have the clever idea to do this as some kind of a promo. But it's been fun. It's all about community. I live in, as you said, Sullivan's Gulch, and it just sort of evolved. I painted it light blue, and I said, hey, everybody, just come on over and paint whatever you want on it. So the kids had a blast, and we've got dog faces. There have been many paint parties, and there's been Grant High School prom party on there where they had a disco ball on there, you know, and so movie nights and sledding with kids and dogs. So it's very much about community And I love how it's evolved, and it was voted best of Portland a few years ago. And the irony, which I'll get into with this whole trying to work with Parks and Rec on this project, is that I've been written up at all the dog parks at least twice by Parks and Rec for having too many dogs. There's a 3-dog limit, and they threatened me with a fine of $150 per dog over that 3-dog limit. And originally I had a 12-pack that I'd take out on the bus. So yeah, they know me well as the person who has way too many dogs, but when they come and write me up, they actually see how well behaved the pack is, and we have a good time, we hit it off. So I haven't been fined, knock on wood, and now I want to be their best friends and work together on this project.
Which is a good transition into the project itself, because those write-ups, if not the fines, were one of the factors that went into it. The project is one to benefit dogs and their owners, which we mentioned, called Rawhide Ranch. I know the project has taken a new turn recently, but what was your initial conception for Rawhide Ranch when you started the planning, which was about 5 years ago?
Yeah, so being written up and having people just harass me for having too many dogs, even though, you know, it's a well-behaved pack. I've been doing this for 15 years, and my pack is sweet, and people comment on that, and I pick up poop whenever I see it. So, you know, it's like I'm part of the good people, but some people just freak out when I have a bunch of dogs come off the bus. So I just finally, you know, got fed up. I'm going to just go and get my own property, a couple acres close in. I'm going to have a structure where we can have live music, we can have a beer and, you know, whatever, trivia night, and let the dogs be safe to run free. So what I'm known for with the dog bus is that I don't do leashes. We don't do leashes.
And these dog parks are leash free anyway, right? Mount Tabor and Delta?
Yes. So, yes, they are leash free.
So you're not flouting the law. It's perfectly within your rights for them to be leash free. Now the initial idea for Rawhide Ranch, which is your own property there, changed. What were some of the factors involved? I know one was a very sad story of Olive the dog, which happened about 2 months ago.
Yes. So what happened, as you said, I started the project 5 years ago, and, you know, got everybody excited. We're going to do this rock and roll video dance party, DJ dance party around the dog bus. Let's everybody get going. And then I was pretty ill for about 4 years, didn't have the strength to keep going with the project. And then not until a year ago last fall did I get back into it and recorded with Figure Eight Sound and got some people around, got my DJ friends out there, and we did have the dance party. And it's just been a slow process editing this video. So I still didn't have like the strength to really do Rawhide Ranch. And, you know, my wife Deb is like, but, you know, you're still going to move forward with this. And I, you know, I'm a student of A Course in Miracles, and I trust my guides. And I just knew I had to keep moving forward with this video, at least not knowing, you know, what was going to become of this project, Rawhide Ranch, that I really didn't have strength for. But the video project was so much fun. We could talk more about that in a bit.
We'll tell listeners where they can see the video too.
Oh yeah,
we'll do that a little later. But I was just interested in what you have in mind now. It's basically not necessarily your own piece of land, but making improvements to the two dog parks that you use quite a bit, Mount Tabor and Delta.
Yeah. So what happened was after walking dogs for 15 years, tragedy happened late October. I've been walking these sweet little terriers, these little blonde terriers, Lucy and Olive, for about 4 years together. They were inseparable. And, sorry.
That's okay.
Little Olive, she's pretty anxious, you know, but the two of them stayed together, and they were both just bundles of joy. I wish y'all could see a picture of Olive. Her eyes, just this old soul and so happy. Well, she finally was branching out on her own, and you know, I had to race out of the park for an emergency, and, you know, the dogs are used to me just setting this pace so they know where I am, they can do their thing and know where I'll be. So when I bolted, she lost sight of us and panicked and got out of the park. And Tabor Park, it's kind of deceptive, you know, it looks fully enclosed, but there's ways out. There's even a path on the east side that just goes right up and around the fence there and the gate. It's just... So,
which is even more difficult for dog owners because they feel that the dog's safe just running around. They don't realize that they can get out of the park.
Yeah, the more people I talk to about this project, a few have said they don't go to that park because their dog has jumped out over the fence and headed towards a very busy division. So, it's just really been interesting talking to people about this project and how everyone says, yeah, it's time, we need to do this. So what I'm doing now is...
I should mention, and I'm sorry I put you through that, Meg, is that it didn't end well for Olive. She was gone for about 5 days, and then they found her passed away.
Yeah, very cold nights. They found her remains. She'd been attacked by a predator, and her parents are my very dear friends, the first people I met here when we first moved here in 2000 from Durango, Colorado. Beautiful people, and... They when we buried her, they didn't want me to see the remains. You know, they were trying to take care of me, but I carry, knowing that they have seen her remains, that they carry that with them their whole life. And poor Lucy is really struggling, you know. So,
but her Olive's memory will live on. Again, you've got plans to with the Rawhide Project to modify the park so that it's much safer for dogs in the future, and these incidents like Olive won't happen again, hopefully.
Right. So, it's a not so smooth transition with this video, because I'm using it for this GoFundMe, firstly to fully enclose Mount Tabor, and I'm working with the Friends of Mount Tabor, and they're a hardy bunch. I'm so excited to work with them, and just that the video is all about partying with your dog, and we're all partying around the dog bus. And so here I'm saying, yes, we're mourning the death of Olive, but look at this video and let's party, you know. So there's that sort of transition into it. But what this whole Rawhide Ranch project was about was to get people together. The whole slogan was Rawhide Ranch, a gathering place, dogs allowed. So once we get Mount Tabor secure, I want to definitely work with Parks and Rec to secure Delta Dog Park, which right now it's dog people, you all know what I'm talking about. So the Delta Sports Arena is over like 85 acres of manicured fields. There's 7 softball fields, there's 9 soccer fields, a football field, beach volleyball where they bring in the sand. There's a concession building. It's still perfectly manicured and no mud. Whilst across the street from it is called the Delta Dog Park, part of this whole plan.
Which has mud.
Oh, my God. They close it every winter because ducks are swimming in there. It's a big mud pit, and the transients have trashed it, and the gates aren't safe. And, you know, in the summer, it doesn't get manicured. And Parks and Rec, they're having a really rough go. They're over $6 million in debt. 50 positions were cut last year, the community programs cut, so they're really having a rough go, and I've been on the phone with them, and they've shut me down, but I came to them with
the
concept.
They don't want to take private funding, even though they're in big financial trouble themselves. It doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Yeah, people come at me, well, you can't approach them, that's private funding. No, you can't private funding, and I'm like, well, yeah, there's a need, let's all come together now. So originally I had approached them with this concept. So now I'm going to just get this together. I got amazing people on board, volunteers wanting to jump on in. I can have fences for Fido with the fencing part of Mount Tabor, just have their direction and the Friends of Mount Tabor.
And you've got some suppliers for the hardware involved, right? The timber, necessary timber and...
Yeah, different timber companies and rebuilding, approach them for donating. And it's just a huge community effort, which is what I originally had planned for this Rawhide Ranch, is for people to come together. So that's what...
And let's talk about the funding. We've just got about a minute or so left, Meg. Where can listeners find out more about the project and help support it if they like? You have a GoFundMe page for Rawhide Ranch.
Yeah, GoFundMe.com. And if you just do a search... Rawhide Portland, and please, I'm just asking everybody who has a dog. I'm doing the Bernie Sanders approach of just throw down $20 each. You know, everybody who has a dog, if we can all just jump in on this. What I have down is $60,000 for this, but it's going to be an ongoing thing. It really needs to be addressed, the needs of your dogs. You know, a lot of people got a puppy for Christmas. They crate, that crate training is just crate all day long. They're on a leash. You know, just like, so they need a place to be safe, to run free. They need a social life. They're just full of energy, and yet they're getting yelled at to just calm the heck down. Well, they need to get out and run, so.
And you're doing great work there with Rawhide Ranch.
Thank you.
Well, Meg, thanks so much for joining us at KBOO. I'll let listeners know where they can get more information. First, Meg Vogt, she's owner of Dog Care Surfers, Dogs Rule and Drive with the Big Blue Dog Bus, and she's working on this Rawhide Ranch project to provide a fun, safe space for dogs and their owners. And you can find out more about Meg and Rawhide Ranch on Facebook at Blue Dog Bus, at Instagram at hashtag Rawhide PDX.
You know what? Actually, I'm not doing another Instagram. I don't need all this social media stuff.
Just look up Instagram. Thing is, go to GoFundMe.com if you're interested in helping out. Just search for Rawhide Ranch or Rawhide Portland and you'll find it. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News In Depth.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59. Coming up next is Labor Radio after these short messages.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow.